Do we have Bruce? We have Lynn. Yay.
How's it going?
It's going good. It's going real good. Yeah, for some reason, yeah, it wasn't. It was calling the radio computer, but it wasn't calling me.
Okay.
So now it's all cool. So, good morning. How are you?
I'm good.
Are you going to be staying in California through Christmas, do you think, or?
Easily, yeah. It'll be for the duration. I'm not sure how long, but for a while.
Oh.
So, who knows?
Well, you're missing the white Christmas out here.
I know. I'm remembering to be a passerby.
Yes. Yeah.
In my Santa months, yes. Yes.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, well, we went and saw the new Star Wars movie last night. Have you seen that?
I have not.
Okay. Well, you know what? It's very like the very original Star Wars.
I kind of figured it would be. I've seen a few, maybe heard more on the radio, just some movie critics talking about the fact that they pulled in some of the original cast and they seemed like they did it very nicely and something like that. So I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, it was really interesting because, of course, having been back in, 1974 or something when it first came out? So my daughter was an infant.
Yeah.
So, you know what, Cheryl? I don't even know who they were. I don't know who the main actors were in the movie. In the new one. I have to go look it up.
Yeah.
Because I never saw these people before. But they were quite engaging. The newer actors were engaging. And then, of course, Harrison Ford was great. And Carrie Fisher was great. And then Mark Hamill was just, well, I'm not going to spoil it. Anyway. it was cool. And I just remember back when, you know, my oldest daughter was a baby, an infant, was when it first came out. And we went, because we lived in Greeley, which is, a much smaller town. And the theater up there it was the new theater, but you know, it's just Greeley. It's not like Denver. And so, people in Denver were waiting in line for hours to get in to see Star Wars, and we just went and walked right in. So, I mean, it was a completely different experience.
Yeah, I guess so. So
we went and saw Star Wars like every day for, you know, quite a while, actually. It was, you know, you could go see it at a cheap matinee in the afternoon. So we were quite enamored with it because, not just because of the story and the, you know, all it was so different, but because I was so fascinated with it because of the Force,
right?
You know, it was
the metaphysics,
yeah.
Which I remember watching Bill Moyers talk to Joseph Campbell about his role in influencing George Lucas and the inspiration for those early films, and of course Joseph Campbell was, you know, basically a scholar of the hero's journey and the spiritual quest and you know, comparative religion and all that kind of stuff, and his hand and his influence are pretty obvious to anyone looking, because it's, you know, it obviously departs from the typical cowboys in outer space scenario to include something that is a little beyond that, and I think that's what the appeal of particularly those first three movies was that theme was carried through in a fairly significant amount, and the idea being that there's something greater than, you know, what we see and that our physical senses can convey, and we need to trust that, and it's like, where have I heard that before?
I know. And actually, though, back in 76, because my daughter, Chloe, was born in 1976. So, okay.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. And so, you know, back then, that was not a common thought. Those were not common thoughts in the country or in the world in general.
Certainly not in the Western world, it would seem.
Yeah, certainly not in the Western world. And well, you know, I think we give the Eastern world a lot more credit than is actually due. Not because they, you know, they aren't more civilized spiritually than we are. It is that they are as lackadaisical. They are as much like Hindu or Buddhist, are as much Hindu or Buddhist as the Westboro Baptist Church is Christian in a lot of ways.
Okay. Sure.
So, you know, we give them credit. We think, oh, these are so spiritual people. But in actuality, they are just the same as we are. They have the same amount of people who are really devout and know and understand the metaphysics of their faith. And then a lot of people, it's just pure sheer superstition. And this is why you have like huge festivals where thousands of animals are slaughtered, like a big sacrificial thing in India. Or, you know, this is why you have ISIS. because, you know, even though the spirituality itself teaches a very fundamental non-dualistic point of view, the people who practice it or are members of the faith don't necessarily practice it. You know,
just like everywhere. I mean, and of course, the miracle circles too.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Because obviously, like Helen Schuckman said, I know it's true. I just don't believe it.
Don't believe it. Yeah.
That was my favorite quote from Helen. Yeah. The off the cuff quote that is.
Yeah. But I guess she was really great and she was a brilliant mind, obviously. A course wouldn't have come like this, couldn't have come through anything less. So what I was then saying then about when Star Wars came out and that general overlying force, the idea that there was something that was beyond even what the normal people were thinking was real about the possibilities about themselves and inherent powers of being connected to this force, all that kind of stuff, that really became a kind of more of a major focus in a lot of households that wouldn't have had that kind of focus in another scenario. So I really credit George Lucas with having, I mean, he actually went to a lot, you know, through a lot of things into the fundamentals of our faith and what we believe, even in like Indiana Jones. Uh-huh. You know, all those Indiana Jones stories are stories about basically something that was given power through the belief of a mind and was therefore, or many minds, and was therefore, you know, some kind of a powerful object that needed to be retrieved. These are all symbols that were just coming like boom, boom, boom to wake us up. So yeah, anyway, I think this Star Wars movie is going to reach out to a new generation of people who haven't had that kind of exposure or are ready for another thought about it. Not that it's inherently spiritual, the movie itself, it really is just a kind of a space Western. Uh-huh. It does, you know, there are some deeper things to think about. So,
yeah. Well, good. Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing it. When you mentioned ISIS and Eastern and almost in this, well, certainly the same paragraph, let's say, I was thinking how I really appreciate President Obama's use of the word ISIL, because it basically doesn't alienate the part of the world that thinks of ISIS as, you know, the Egyptian and ISIS and Osiris mythology, and the idea that there's a, you know, divine feminine masculine, which again is a polarity, but it's the idea that there's a higher aspect or a deeper understanding, or a, you know, again, it's basically a kindness that is expressed by not dissing someone's religious background, even if that from whatever perspective we may have or not have may be partial or incomplete. I think that kind of ties into, you know, what we just started off talking about is the, you know, the cowboys and Indians in space, you know, the space Western idea is, again, good guys versus bad guys. And I actually had a conversation with a family member the other day, and it was interesting to just reflect on how when I was a kid, I used to, you know, kind of somewhat buy into that idea that there are people that are, you know, wearing the white hats and some wearing the black hats. And now it's like, well, wait a minute, don't we all, what ties us all together? I mean, just 7 billion plus, you know, all the entirety of what we think of as humanity on this planet, plus all the animal, mineral, and vegetable life and everything else, subatomic to galactic, what ties us as one quality is that, or one, you know, one thing, one aspect, one essence is that we all have a decision-making mind, and we all have the ability to choose between the right-minded, as the Course puts it, and wrong-minded thinking, which then leads us, if we consistently and, you know, practice the forgiveness that the Course talks about by choosing the right mind and having shared interests and seeing, you know, the opportunities for compassion and kindness and inclusion back to, that's sort of the horizontal polarity. And, you know, and that basically recognizes that we all have, you know, those same two thought systems and the decision-making capacity and within us. And one of Ken's audios the other day kind of clicked for me, and Ken Wapnick's recorded material, where he talks about the level one polarity and the level two polarity that the Course deals with, and the way he described it was really was clarifying to me, and the gist of that was that the level one polarity is between truth and illusion, and of course, truth has no opposite because illusion doesn't exist. But within the illusion, there's that other polarity. So it's sort of like a, you know, I think of a triangular configuration with truth, the upper corner or vertex of the triangle, and then below that are two other vertices or corners. And so the lower polarity between wrong and right-mindedness, as the Course describes it, or ego and Holy Spirit, or the false self and the real self, you know, or at least the mind that brings us to the real self, is the black and white that every single person carries around with them. That, you know, we're all ambivalent, we're all equivocating and vacillating and going back and forth between those two thought systems until we finally recognize the utter ridiculousness of trying to make ego work, and by using the right-minded illusion, we get back to the decision-making point in the mind, and at one point, just, you know, leave the theater altogether. Say enough of this movie, and that's when we, you know, return to the truth that we truly never left. That is all-encompassing. That includes everyone, and then the dream is no more because it never was, and which we can't really, you know, get our heads around because that's. And I think that's why so much of the Course is written on level two, because that's where we think we are. We think we, you know, our bodies, we think that we're in a world that has all these issues. And so we need to deal with that. And so another one of Ken's comments I thought was really good is if all that was needed to be expressed in the Course was, you know, the pure, absolute, non-dual truth, Helen would have dictated God is and put her shorthand notes down, and that would have been it.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't have been terribly helpful because that's not where we think we are. We think we're in the world of form, and we need to be gently guided back to the world in our mind of content, and how the right-minded thinking that the Course talks about. And it's not right in any kind of polarized way, but right in terms of correct, I think, might be a better adjective, at least in my mind. or useful or inclusive or anyway, but that thinking leads us away from the sin, guilt, fear paradigm of the ego. Lynn, I had a thought while I was thinking about our conversation this morning. I was just listening to, and I do this on my phone just because it's kind of fun to select one of the 1,300 plus frequently asked questions. And if you set your phone up for the ability to speak, you can have it actually dictate the whole thing to you. So in my sort of semi-hypnagogic state this morning, listening to this, I listened to FAQ number 1001 from the FACM site. And I was thinking if you want to bring that up, we could read that and talk about it. Would you be open to doing that?
Sure. Let me go to my browser.
Okay. while you're doing that, if you just go to facim.org and then click on the supplemental material, or you can go, quickest way is actually facimoutreach.org and then the QA. But the one I'm looking at this morning and I had listened to is question 1001. I just passed the 1,000 mark going through the
sequence. Wait a second. Now let me look here. I went to facim.org, and so go to facim outreach, all one word?
Facimoutreach.org. Yeah, that's actually a shortcut to get there.
Okay. Let me just do that because it's...
And then if you go to the list of all questions, I felt like, let me do it myself all so I don't lead you astray.
Oh, now I screwed it up. I put in the wrong thing. FACIM Outreach, right?
FACIMOutreach.org.
Oh, outreach. I guess if I put an R in it, it might work for me.
Yeah, there we go. And then if you... where it says how to use this site at the bottom of the page, there says list of all questions below.
Okay.
So click on that and go to, let's see, I think it's part 5. Is that the one? Yeah, actually it's part 4, I think.
Okay.
So back up here and get to the right one.
Okay.
Part 4, nope. Questions 2000.
Part 3. Did you say 1001?
Yeah, 1001. So if you scroll down on the part 4 to 1001, and that's in the questions from September 6, 2006.
To make this bigger, I can't hardly see it at all.
Okay.
So teeny tiny. So let's see, 10, 20.
I just thought this would be really appropriate for the holiday season, since Christmas is less than a week away, and for a lot of people who celebrate that particular holiday, but just the seasons in general of, you know, the darkest time of the year, which really metaphysically and metaphorically can be an opportunity to look at the darkness in our mind, and because that's all that the Course in Miracles really asks us to do, is look at it and judge it not.
All right.
Let's not. So.
Exactly.
Anyway, so, I was thinking maybe we just read a sentence and then maybe read the question first and then read a sentence at a time from the answer.
Okay.
And then talk about it, because I think there's plenty there. And particularly in a season when people are so, you know, strung out and stressed about trying to get so much done, and the whole idea of thinking that we need to achieve something in the world and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But this, I think this is, even though that's not the exact nature of this question, I think it addresses a lot of similar thoughts. So anyway, I'll just go ahead and start reading the question. Question 1001. Again, this is from facimoutreach.org, the Q&As. I'm a high school dropout. I have made an ego that never was able to make an adult life for herself. I feel so isolated and helpless to change the loneliness that I want to die. In my 55 years, I have failed at everything that I have tried to do. Mental illness and emotional disturbance are what my life has been, and I see no hope out of this living hell. Well, I think we can all, when we're honest of ourselves, you know, and we're identified with our egos, that's just it, isn't it? But this is just the ego I made up. Jesus said I could see peace instead of this because I am not this wretched ego! Exclamation point. I know that intellectually, but it doesn't make any difference. It doesn't stop the pain. Can you please point me in the right direction as I try to accept God's help and experience peace? So you want to read the first sentence of the answer? And we'll just talking about it.
Okay. So, and I think a lot of people can identify with this question. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, not just seasonally, but overall. I mean, you know, it's not a temporal thing, but it certainly could be emphasized this time of year.
So the first sentence says that it may be of some comfort to you for you to know that you are not alone.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it, isn't it? And that's what we're just talking about, is that how, you know, the ego wants us to make it black and white and say, well, that person or that group is the black hats and the bad guys, and this group over here is the good guys, and we're in the good guy circle. Or sometimes we, you know, turn the tables, you know, if we're listening to the ego and you know, reverse the thing and make ourselves the bad guys if we allow the guilt to the unconscious guilt to paint the dream with that thought system. So anyway, but we're all in the same boat. We all have the same decision-making mind, the same ego thought system, and the same kindness thought system, the same inner kindness teacher that the Course calls Holy Spirit or the Jesus of the Course, right? So,
yeah. So
we're all in the same boat.
The next sentence says, the pain you describe is the inevitable experience of everyone when the mind chooses to believe that separation from God is possible and has been accomplished. And boy, is that ever the absolute reason for everything. You know,
yeah.
People say, well, it's the I am thought. Well, it is. It's the I am something different and special and different and separate from God.
Right.
That belief that I am something that is different and separate from God, that's the cause of all, everything. You can't go beyond that as far as looking for the cause of our suffering, because it's just right there, and it's universal. There can be nothing else that could be the cause. And every time you look at anything that seems to be going wrong in your life, if you got down to the point where you recognized, would a sane mind see it this way? And would God have made a world where this is possible?
Yeah, yeah.
And when you recognize that God would not have made a world where that is possible, a sane mind would see beyond that, and we are all sane. Every single one of us has a sane mind. Mm-hmm. We can just turn to that.
Right, right.
It's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the willingness to look at the insanity of having believed that it was possible, having believed that separation from God was possible, that made up this, you know, hellish existence that we try to, you know, gloss over and make nice and you know, decorate and adorn with all the trappings of the world that are very fleeting and ephemeral and you know, not that there's anything wrong with, you know, all the comforts that are possible and all the magic spells and incantations and rituals and what, you know, the whole range of stuff that we do to try to comfort ourselves in the world. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, why wouldn't we do those things? But if we can just do it like Ken says, with a, you know, a grain of salt, with just a little smile in our eye as we're doing those things, and say, oh yeah, I'm thinking that somehow I'm going to outdo God, and I've done one better by making up a world where I'm on my own, but I'm still, you know, able to pull off having this glee of, you know, making up a world where I'm enjoying, we think, being off on our own. And yet it never happened. We never pulled it off. So, yeah. Okay, the next sentence is, the anguish is often denied, covered over, and camouflaged, but it is universal for all the separated ones. And that the camouflage and the covering over is the focus of the last Academy class that the folks at Temecula that put put this together, did last month, which was about the masks we wear. And I just had a conversation with C.A. Brooks that I put up on ACIM blog last night, that if anybody's interested in it, where she took really good notes and we read through those. but the idea being is that, you know, we cover it over. We pretend, oh, everything's fine. And not that, you know, we don't need to make anything up. There's a commentary that Ken Wapnick did on Workbook Lesson 182 that's just wonderful. And it talks about the little child, and that it's really the Christ child that is basically patiently waiting. And we think that that's really vulnerable, and yet that's where our eternal strength is. And it's just patiently this innocence, this perfect innocence that includes everyone, not the ego's fake innocence that paints, you know, the paint that says, oh, there's good guys and bad guys. But it's the true innocence where, like you were saying, Glenn, that, you know, we all have that within us, and we all have that force, as the Star Wars sagas would suggest, that says there must be a better way. Yeah. So where were we? Oh, I think that the separated ones is the last part of that sentence we just finished. You want to read the next one?
Sure. Yeah, I was babysitting a baby monitor, so my daughter just came to get it. So
oh, okay. Okay.
My son allowed us to work. So I was going to say something about this, and somehow or the other it went out of my mind. Maybe it'll come back.
Okay. We're all out of our minds.
It's the veil of oblivion.
Yes.
See, this is what is so hard for people to understand, is that we have very cleverly made it so that it is impossible to know this, because we hide it from ourselves. We hide it from ourselves. And the instant that it is thought of, we bury it. And because it's, you know, that completely would destroy the integrity of the matrix if we actually saw this. If we actually let ourselves see the truth, then there would be, you know, definitely some glitches in the matrix that would not be we couldn't justify, we couldn't rectify our minds with. And so so this is why you know, and it's purposive, and it is also something that we accept without question.
Right.
And in fact, you know, you may have this vaguely uneasy feeling that something, I'm missing something, but it's you don't see it because, like I said, we hide it so cleverly.
Oh, very cleverly. In fact, as you were talking about the Matrix, funny you should mention a virtual reality movie, because I was actually thinking of another favorite, which is The Truman Show. And in that film, there's a hint in before the end of the film where the character Jim Carrey plays, which is Truman, of course, has his suspicions are aroused when one of the stage lights falls from the sky and crashes to the ground, and he looks up, and of course all he sees is the blue sky, and it's like, what's going on here? But, you know, and we think that, wow, what an amazing, extensive, they made this huge sound stage covering miles so that he, you know, believed that he was in this little city with everybody smiling at him and waving and saying, you know, good morning and good afternoon to him. And as he, you know, went through his little utopian life, you know, and forget, not even knowing, according to this film anyway, that it was all a movie. And then finally at the end of the film, he's determined to find, you know, what is beyond this? You know, there must be a better way, in other words, and that there must be something more than this, you know, that emptiness. And so he goes, and, you know, against all the obstacles that symbolically our ego puts in the way, to don't learn that this is a movie, you know, that he finds the border of one of the borders of the soundstage by getting in a boat, and they unleash these storms against him and everything, and, you know, made up storms, of course, so that his boat is tossed and tumbled in this made up body of water on this giant soundstage, and he finally navigates to where he sees the staircase off in the distance, and it's like, what's that? And then he realized that's the exit, or at least one of the exits anyway, that he's able to find, and he climbs up the staircase and leaves the soundstage. And well, and that's what I think the course is asking us to do, to say, hey, wait a minute, there's got to be more here. And if we can see, like Ken Wapnick says, that everything is propaganda for itself, not just a few little things or symbolic messengers, but everything. And that's why those early workbook lessons are so potent. You know, I've given everything in this room, in this, on the street, in, you know, and so forth, all the meaning it has for me. Because basically disciples of ego, we're buying into hook, line, and sinker, all the special effects, all the stage props, and we're believing that it's real. We think that. I thought of that this morning when I got up and, you know, staggered as I usually do into the bathroom and looked in the mirror, and it's like, oh yeah, that's right. This is a prop. This is not my real self. This is a staged enactment of a character in a dream in a movie. And anyway,
so yeah,
it's a good thing to remember. And I think the more we remember it, the more we can cultivate that inner smile and begin to gently laugh at our own Truman Show and how we all are complicit in that exercise.
Yeah. Well, if I remind myself of that and notice it, see, this is the thing that's so amazing for me anyway. I don't know about anybody else's experience, but once I started noticing this,
mm-hmm.
I started seeing it everywhere.
Yeah.
Once I started noticing that, oh, this is, you know what, this is the same story. It just has different characters, or this little bit is different here or there, but it's the same story.
Right.
I call this my bathroom revelation, because in the middle of the night, when I get up in the middle of the night and use the bathroom, all these I have all these things. You know, that's where I got that Einstein and Freud. I had that dream. I got up and I went in the bathroom and wrote that poem down. That's not just what happens. But I remember just, you know, looking at the tiles on the floor and thinking of how many times I have sat on that very throne and looked at those very same tiles on the floor and how, you know, everything is just a repeat over and over and over and over. And in fact, so much of our life is just repetitive, just to keep that that pattern of oblivion going on there. You don't question it, as long as it's not out of the certain parameters what you can handle in your mind, what the ego mind can handle, then it's all cool. When something comes from out of there, though, and that's what, you know, Course in Miracles, this is what revelation, you know, I've heard voices speak to me. I've heard, you know, I've seen things that were not even there, but, you know, I know too that, you know, we only see a very small percentage of any spectrum, and we only have a very, very tiny range of sound. So there could be things speaking to us all over the place. We could be seeing, you know, billions of, you know, things right now, rather than the very limited things that we're seeing and hearing. But when those things do break through, you get this thought, oh, there's something beyond this.
Yeah. And
it is these something beyond us moments that bring us to question the pattern. It's they're out of pattern. What is it the miracle principle says?
That's right. That's, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That there's something that just happened that just snap you out of the matrix for a moment.
I think that, I think you're quoting something early in the text that might be in near the 50 miracles principles or close to it.
It's a 50 miracle principle thing.
Yeah, I think it's in one of those, actually. Out of miracles or something out of pattern, something or other. I'd have to Google it, but anyway.
I'd have to look it up too, because I don't memorize. But that's what it is. So these two sentences that I'm going to just read again, together. I think you read the first one. The pain of separation cannot be dismissed with an intellectual understanding of its origin as taught by the metaphysics of A Course in Miracles. In fact, using the principles of the Course to try to squelch the pangs of pain only exacerbates the problem. Mm-hmm. So
when we try to do a number on ourselves, it's usually because we're trying to solve the problem as egos, which of course is saying that the ego doesn't exist. And egos don't like to solve their own problem, which is why they always, you know, why the projection is such a popular thing to do. And we project an entire universe just so that it would have a seemingly seamless tiling. Interestingly enough, I'm working on a seamless tile for a website that you'll recognize when it's all done with a very talented artist. But the tiling is the lengths that we go to make sure everything fits together and doesn't leave any gaps, so that no light can come through. You know, it's as long as we seal out the light, then it seems to be, you know, hermetically sealed. But, you know, elsewhere in the Course, it says it may be foolproof, but it's not God-proof, you know. And all it takes is one, you know, light crashing down from the soundstage or noticing the door at the end of the ocean coming up from the staircase, emerging from the ocean. It's like, oh, well, you know, maybe there's another way of looking at things here. But we get those glimpses, and we can use everything. If we have an inquisitive mind that says, what if I were to see this differently? What if I was to see this as not something outside myself, but as an aspect of my own projection, and I could bring it back inside, look at it with my inner kindness teacher, and that willingness to do that is reflected often in those shared interests and the little kindnesses and the just the everyday things that we do to not make ourselves alienated from the people in our lives and to embrace everyone as equal and on the same path and in the same boat as we row over to that door on the soundstage.
Row, in spite of all odds. And that's it. That's exactly what the miracle does. And I just posted that miracle principle that I was thinking of. The miracle is number 47. The miracle is a learning device that lessens the need for time. It establishes an out of pattern time interval, not under the usual laws of time. In this sense, it is timeless. So this is more in terms of time, but of course, as Einstein and Freud explained to me very clearly, time and space are the same thing. So what appears to be something happening even in the form realm of physical form is really an expression of that time, time, because it's the same thing, form and time are, you know, basically the same thing that have been just split right. apart to make right. the physical world possible.
Yep.
And so, so whenever anything glitches like that, it's something that, jumps us up into a higher level of thinking, switches on something that, brings us into, a higher mind, because you were explaining earlier, and I think I didn't hear the whole explanation, that triangle that Ken was talking about.
Oh, that's just a geometric metaphor I find helpful.
Right. But the two base, the point of the triangle is,
well, there's two polarities, basically. So you can actually kind of imagine an upside down T,
okay,
if you will. So the top of point really is the truth that we never left. And so the first polarity, and that kind of I think it kind of fits in with the four splits that Ken talks about, which there's actually a whole series of books that I've got that haven't opened yet, but I'm looking forward to reading about that. But I know that you know, one of the stages is that, you know, we decide that we don't, you know, we want to do something different, you know, and again, that's we can't even fathom how that would be possible because it isn't. But you know, there's no opposite to truth, But in our minds, we think that there is. And so that's the polarity, the seeming polarity between truth and illusion. And within the realm of illusion, there's the other polarity, which is the other two points of the triangle, you know, metaphorically and symbolically underneath, which is the right mind and the wrong mind, as the Course puts it, which is basically, you know, the thought system that doesn't work to make us happy, and the one that does. So, you know, use whatever labels are, but essentially, you know, I like our inner kindness teacher, because I think that encapsulates for me, you know, pretty practical everyday thing. Is if I feel unhappy or out of peace or out of balance or in any way less than joyous, I know that in those moments I've been listening to the wrong mind.
The mind
that is basically identifying with the dream and the shields of oblivion and the wanting to keep the projections intact, and that doesn't want me to roll over to the end of the sound stage and climb the ladder, you know, climb the staircase and walk out the door kind of thing. It's like, wait a minute, we've got serious problems to deal with here first. You know, you can't just leave the script. Come on.
I got to make sure that my family's being fed, and I got to make, you know, and nobody even thinks about it. You do think about it, you know, if you're dying, oh, who's going to take care of all these, all this stuff. But when you're dead, that's no longer part of your thought system. So here you bring up a question that I think we probably don't even have time to talk about this morning, but I'm going to bring it up anyway, is a lot of Course in Miracles students that I have spoken with believe that the right mind is the Holy Spirit. And the left mind, the wrong mind, is the ego. However, I think that both the right mind and the wrong mind are a part of the illusion.
And the Course says that.
It is the ego all the way. But the ego is only capable of having levels.
I think that the Course would phrase it differently. I think from what I've read anyway, the Holy Spirit, also known as the Jesus of the Course, is part of illusion, but with one crucially important difference. It's the only parts of that of the entire thought system of illusion that lead out of illusion. Everything else that the ego does, what the Course refers to as wrong mindedness, leads further into identification with the illusion.
Right, but it's still part of the illusion, though.
Of course. It's anything that has to do with polarity can't possibly be real in the pure non-dual metaphysics of the Course. But since that's not where we spend most of our time, we need the voice that we took with us into the dream, so to speak, the quality of awareness that says there's got to be a better way, and that says, yeah, it's okay to look at the insanity, and that the instant we start looking at it, then we start identifying with the light, which is shining down on the polarity, and eventually we just say, well, why would I want to mess with that?
Exactly. Because we align ourselves with the Force.
Yeah.
That's what the force is in our dream. And we're aligning ourselves with it. So that is really what Jesus is telling us to do. And so this sentence says, in fact, using the principles of the Course to try to squelch the pangs of pain only exacerbates the problem. Right. That's what people do. People actually use the principles of the Course to make guilt. They actually use, oh, I didn't do my lesson right. I didn't do my lesson today. Oh, I'm judging this person. Oh, I haven't forgiven. All of those things that are basic principles of the Course that are meant to give joy.
Right.
are actually being used by the ego and the wrong mind, the ego mind, to bring us pain and cause us to feel guilty and cause us to argue amongst ourselves and each other, who are equally, you know, dying for this solution as well. And yet we're willing to kill each other over which version of the course you're reading, or if, you know, it was in Helen's notes, or they found the notes in Helen's underwear drawer, or whatever, you know. We're willing to you know, fight and die for that. And it doesn't seem like it because we're gentle, sweet course students. But in reality, when these conversations come up, there is murder in the mind.
Well, that's the only, that in truth, that's the only premise that the ego has, is that it killed God. And so it's just reenacting that in seemingly gentler and less horrific forms over and over. But, you know, and it tries to again, the mask, it tries to camouflage and say, oh, well, you know, I'm not that murderous self, you know. But how could you dare accuse me of that? But if we look at that, the beauty of what the Course is suggesting is that if we look at the ego as a totally insane, murderous thought system that is fleeing, you know, like a fugitive from truth because it thinks it's shattered truth, then it makes perfect sense. And then it becomes clear. It's like, oh, yeah, I can see. And we can see that in so much of what motivates us. And it, you know, initially it's really scary because we say, oh, my gosh, and how much of what I do during the day is just trying to, you know, maintain this fugitive approach of oh, I got to get to the next store to buy Christmas presents, or I got to make this meal, or I got to, you know, whatever. You know, I'm just picking a couple of seasonal yeah. examples, but you know, if you look at my
to-do list.
Well, anybody's to-do list, you know, but if we can just look at the craziness of which the ego, you know, like the Course says, of all the causes of your suffering, I'm going to paraphrase this, of course, like do most everything, you never thought that guilt was among them, right? That's the last place we'd ever want to look, because we think that if we looked at that, then it would seal the deal, and we would be forever condemned. And we think that there's still a chance in the dream if we can somehow keep coming at it from a different angle, which is basically trying to use the ego to you know, fix the problem of the ego, which is kind of insane. And once we see that we're in the desert, as Ken Welpink says, we leave.
Get out.
Well, there's nothing else to do but leave. Yeah, okay. It's like, but in the meanwhile, if we can just be gentle with ourselves as we notice those horrific thoughts, and ego's fleeing its homeland. Yeah, exactly. You got to thank you. So if we can see how crazy that is, and then not condemn ourselves, and I think that's where, you know, Ken rightly points out in the middle of workbook lesson 95, where he changes the tone of the conversation long enough for a few paragraphs to say, hey, if you catch yourself feeling guilty for, you know, having the discipline to remember the lessons throughout the day, congratulations, you're getting it, because you're seeing the resistance that's there. You're seeing how much we don't want to do this course, how much our egos hate this course, and how quickly we forget it after we finish this conversation and go about the stuff of the day, or we go to a workshop, you know, a course-related workshop, or, you know, Ken used to describe it as a giant vacuum cleaner that sucked all the ideas that were talked about during the academy class or the workshop or whatever out, you know, the top of everybody's head as they left the room, you know. And but that's the whole thing, isn't it? It's because we don't want to do the course, and being willing to look at the part of us that doesn't want to have the discipline and the mindfulness and the kindness, and that wants to indulge in the divisive thinking that keeps us separate, being willing to look at that and not condemn ourselves for it. That's huge. To look at our resistance and not condemn ourselves for it, or condemn anyone else as we see it, you know, expressed in the alleged others, that is huge, isn't it? Because that lets us and everyone else off the hook at the same time.
Exactly.
And then the next paragraph, of course, goes into that. I'm not sure how far we'll get into this, but it says, Jesus acknowledges the feelings of separation engenders when he tells us in the workbook, you think you are the home of evil, darkness, and sin. You think if anyone could see the truth about you, he would be repelled, recoiling from you as if from a poisonous snake. You think if what is true about you were revealed to you, you would be struck with horror so intense that you would rush to death by your own hand. Well, isn't this, you know, alleged life just a long drawn out suicide of one sort or another? Yeah. Living on after seeing this is impossible. And that's from workbook lesson 93. And then he says, notice he does not say some of you may think this. These words apply equally to those who view themselves as failures and to those who consider themselves great successes on the world's terms. So he's saying that, you know, all the people that make the tabloids and the headlines that, you know, we hold up as, you know, celebrities of either entertainment or politics or, you know, sports or, you know, whatever. I mean, pick a category. The things that the people that we idolize are dealing with the same stuff. It's how could it be any different? And the people that we consider to be, you know, the most, you know, pity-worthy souls, they're no different. We're all dealing with the same two thought systems. It's all the same black and white inside our mind, but we like to paint it out there and assign hats of those
exactly.
two colors.
Well, yeah. And what's so beautiful, though, Bruce, is that once you begin to realize and recognize, which is what Ken is pointing out here, once we begin to recognize that it's not just some of us who think this way,
right.
It is everyone who thinks this way. And people will say, well, you don't know me, and I don't think this way, and you don't. No, Jesus does know you, and Jesus does know how you think. Jesus does know how the ego mind is. And unless you are thinking in the same exact way that Jesus is thinking, unless you are seeing things in the same exact way as Jesus, who is identified with the Christ, is seeing things, then you are seeing things in this way, which is thinking that you are the most horrible thing that ever lived. You don't deserve to live. You should die. And that is very true. Absolutely true.
Yeah.
Of the ego.
right. And how? What other assessment could the ego make of itself other than, you know,
I'm bad.
A hive of wretched scum and villainy, to quote an early, misquote the first Star Wars movie. How's that? I was talking about.
They had a bar in the movie, too.
The Star Wars Cantina, yeah. And what was it that Ben Kenobi said? You've never seen a more wretched hive of scum and villainy, something like that.
Yeah.
You know, but what a great
villainy, I think.
What a great description of the ego's mind, you know? It's just, we think we're the home of evil, darkness, and sin, but not just some people, everybody, because that's the default, you know, secret. That's the outer secret is the world, but the inner secret is that we think that behind the world there's this guilt, but it's all made up. The guilt is just as fake, just as false, just as much of a special effects extravaganza of the mind as the entire material universe is.
Well, and actually, I think Jesus explains to us, which, and I, when I first read it, I was kind of blown away, but it's in several places in the Course. He says the guilt is the actual fiber of the universe. The guilt is actually what the entire physical world is made of. So
right.
If the guilt is gone, there is no physical world because there's nothing to hold. There's nothing to hold everything in a place where it doesn't fit.
Yes.
And that's what we do with guilt. We try to assign everything to a position so that it stays where it's at, so that we can continue to express and live in this physical body, physical world. And it's so tightly held. The tension on it is so volatile.
Mm-hmm.
That to even split, I mean, splitting the atom is a very good example of what would happen if we split our guilt away from our thought system. If we just completely tore that apart, the bits that are holding the universe together, there would be a huge something.
Right. Well,
It's
and that huge something is the cosmos externally, and it's the thought system of guilt that we are blind to internally until we start looking at it with our inner kindness teacher, with Holy Spirit, and say, let's just look at this a little at a time so you don't freak out and, murder yourself basically by thinking that that's all there is. But if we look at it together, our inner kindness teacher and I, if we look at it one symbol at a time, one special effect prop at a time, one incredibly talented actor at a time, and all of us are those theatrical geniuses, and see that this is an incredibly elaborate script, and we can afford to gently laugh at taking it, the idea of taking it seriously. And by doing that, we reveal a little bit of what's behind the soundstage, which is the incredibly comforting and soothing and eternally peaceful light that we all are, that we can't even imagine, but we get little glimpses of because we feel peaceful. In those moments when we're willing to question the ego's thought system, we feel peaceful. And it's like, oh yeah, this really works. What do you know? So we need to be patient with ourselves when we go back and forth, and we keep thinking, oh well, if I try this ego approach, maybe from this angle today, I never tried that specific combination of 3 billion, variables. Maybe that one will work for me, and I can still make this dysfunctional dead horse work, but it never does, but we keep trying.
We keep trying, and eventually we all come to see, which I think you and I have both come to see pretty much of the time, that that actually forgiveness works.
It does.
It's it
It
does.
does.
Yep. I mean, I'm
Fancy
telling
that.
you, Bruce, this I have actually literally seen a change in things that I thought would never be able to be shifted. And I directly attribute it to, and I know this probably sounds egoic, but I directly attribute it to my use of forgiveness, that when I'm able to look at a situation and not see it as being real, permanent, capable of real effects. Absolutely, it is just a mask that's being put on. For instance, if a person seems to be someone who's bothering me or giving me some kind of discomfort, because of anything. It could be anything. It could be they have body odor. I don't know. It could be anything. And I can look at that. I can actually practice forgiveness on it. And not only does it shift my mind so that I am in a happy place, a kind place, and a loving place, it also shifts their behavior. And people stop behaving in ways that are causing anxiety when there's no gift in it for them. If they aren't going to get anything out of it, they stop doing it.
Exactly. When we drop our lightsabers and get out of our stormtrooper costume, we give the opportunity to everyone around us to respond from a place of love and kindness. They don't have to f follow that cue because everybody's following their own choices in terms of decision making. But it makes it more available, and because it doesn't always seem to change the exterior, but what it does is it changes how we feel moment to moment, and that accumulates and builds, and we realize that it doesn't matter what's happening in the dream if in the real world, if in our mind where we have forgiven, we are basically building a link back to the real self that we never left, that isn't the Lynn, that isn't the Bruce. It's the decision-making faculty in our minds that chose to take on these roles, that you know, picked up the lightsabers and the stormtrooper uniforms, and decided that we needed to fight this galactic battle. And it's just a dream. It's just a movie, you know. It's come on.
It's crazy. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly, Bruce. Well, it looks like our time is up, speaking of.
Yes. Thank you for sharing this with me again.
Yeah. And sorry about last week. The recording was so bad because my mic was bad.
Oh, I could tell. I could tell. Yeah, I'm sure people who are you know, looking or listening to it could figure that there were some technical issues. But the content that made it through was good.
Oh, I thought great.
I enjoyed everything you shared. Yeah.
But today I'll send you this recording. It should be pretty good. All right, great. Bruce. Well, I love you so much. Thank you.
Likewise.
Thank you. And
happy holidays.
Week.
Yeah.
I will see you after Christmas.
Yeah. Have a great week, all.
All right, then. Bye-bye.